Jamie, can you just quickly do a sound test for us so we can hear you? Okay, I cannot
can you hear me?
Now we can. Could you?
Now we can.
Oh. All right, so thank you. Well, welcome to everyone. It's officially starting time. And what we're going to be doing this morning is Hugh's going to be doing his webinar. The first 15 minutes will be Q&A. So if you have questions, please feel free to flow them into the Q&A. Any questions that you have for each other, please send those to the chat. If you have a multi-part question, then you'll have to break it up and send in two questions because I won't be able to ask multi-part questions unless they're tightly related to each other, like a question for a definition or something like that. I do want to let everybody know also that next week, Hugh will be away. However, we have Dr. Eric Heiden, H-E-D-I-N, who will be in. And he's going to be talking about his new book called Canceled Science, What Atheists Don't Want You to Know. And so Eric is a very interesting speaker, and the subject of his book will be of great interest to this group. So I encourage you to come next week, too, and pose questions to Eric as well. So with that, it looks like we've already got one question. It looks like Tom Wee. And Tom says, Dr. Ross, I'm very much encouraged by your charitable and respectful attitude towards persons with differing views and your emphasis on Christian evangelism. Although there are a number of theological differences, generally I agree more with RTB views, which represent one among three major views of faith and science among evangelical Christians. I recognize there is also quite a diversity among old earth creationists. Could you share any further anecdotes about the reception of your books, like Weathering Climate Change and Who is Adam, as evangelistic tools among Christians and missionaries in the global South?
Yeah, good question. And, you know, our big problem is often people haven't heard of Reasons to Believe or know of our books, but when they discover them, they appreciate the value they have in persuading non-Christians to seriously consider the Christian faith. So that typically is what I've noticed, is that when theologians find our books, they immediately think of non-Christians that they can give the books away to, even if they don't agree with our theological perspective. But a lot of them, once they dig into it, they really do seem to see the value of the dual revelation perspective we take that is being manifested right now in this class. There's a follow-up, I'll be happy to take it.
Great, thank you. The next question is from Travis Worth. Dr. Ross, what role do you think the philosophy of science plays in fine-tuning arguments?
Well, Mark, I think you're probably better positioned to answer that question since you've got a degree in philosophy of science. So I'm going to let you answer it.
Okay. Well, Travis, the role of a philosophy of science in fine-tuning arguments is at least the first point is the question, is a fine-tuning argument really a legitimate argument? So that's not a scientific question, that's a philosophical question. So the role of philosophy of science starts at the very nature of the question itself. The next one is when you're looking at fine-tuning, you're looking at accretion of evidence. And the inferences you draw from that evidence can fall into several categories. And those categories, abductive, for example, or deductive, or any other kind of form of logic, are all the kinds of things that the philosophy of science has something to do with. So the kinds of inferences we're making when we're looking at fine-tuning arguments, the fact that we're using fine-tuning at all as an argument for the existence of God, and then also the definitions that come from those are all parts of the philosophy of science. And those are all implicated in the fine-tuning argument. And the last one is the fine-tuning argument a cumulative argument or is it a collective argument? So in other words, is it an argument that has a certain point at which it becomes saturated, or is it an argument that constantly requires new information in order to keep it legitimate and inductively strong? So those are some of the things, I don't want to go on too long, but those are some of the things where philosophy of science has a direct effect, and only philosophy of science answers those particular questions. So thanks a lot, Travis, I appreciate that.
Yeah, good answer, Mark. And I think with fine-tuning, the cumulative thing is particularly powerful. The fact that we're always learning and enhancing the fine-tuning argument with every scientific discovery that goes by.
Somebody asked, why does Mark look like a monk sometimes? let me look at myself here. Oh, I see why. I know why, because I have a black t-shirt and I have a hoodie that's black. So I look like a monk.
Yeah, especially if you put the hood up.
It'll be scary then. Okay.
Call you Darth Vader.
I couldn't help but answer that one publicly. All right. So Chris Thompson from Anchorage says, when might we see the revision of Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men?
Well, when I get through maybe two more books, because that is on the list, is to put out a second edition of that book. And, you know, with the help of our scholar community, that might happen sooner rather than later. Already it's a multi-author book. So, the chapters I wrote definitely need some updating. There's been a lot of new discoveries that are relevant. So yeah, it's something we're definitely planning. Hopefully we'll get it out by 2024, 2025, that's the goal. So I'd love it if we can release it at the time of the solar eclipse.
What kinds of new things would you be wanting to put in it that you didn't have in the first one?
Well, we have a much stronger argument now for why it's not possible for physical beings to go from interstellar across interstellar space. When we wrote the book back in 2002, we were able to say, hey, for certain, we know that there is an advanced civilization capable of a space travel within 200 light years. We can now push that out throughout our entire galaxy. So that really does eliminate the possibility that we're being visited by physical aliens like ourselves. And then there's been a lot more release of public data. So, the fact that nations around the world are now releasing what was once classified material on UFO sightings, that definitely needs to be discussed.
When I was talking with Mark Clark a few days ago, he was describing some of the interesting possibilities that could come from the kinds of military tests that have been going on lately, that some people don't even realize that parts of the government don't know what other parts of the government are doing.
That's true. I mean, that's why they made Area 51 twice as big as it used to be, to keep these UFO people away from what they're really doing.
Yeah.
And I think I'm going to put a couple of stories in the next edition too, because I've had some experiences when I was doing astronomy of a strange craft hovering over our observatories, and how the military denied they had those kind of craft. But now we know they really did.
Oh, that's interesting. Well, it'll be fun. I'm as eager as the person who asked that question to see that book come out, because I've seen a lot of the new data and a lot of new evidence coming out. And I think there are a lot more explanations that narrow it down to that problem of the demonic realm.
Well, particularly, when I was in Russia in around 1990, the incidence of UFO sightings was really high, and now it's gone way down. So that was something I couldn't report on back in 2002, but we can now.
Okay. So, well, that's good to hear. Well, it looks like we're not getting a lot of questions right now. Did you want to start your webinar a little early?
I could start the webinar a little early. That'd be great.
Okay.
So let me do that.
And then it'll be all yours.
Yeah. And we'll have a Q&A time after my teaching time. So if you've got questions, you can be thinking about them or writing them down. So we'll do that. And I'll be teaching for about 30, 35 minutes. But let me open our time in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for this technology that allows us to engage one another like this. And we look forward to the day real soon when we'll be able to have in-person meetings as well as maintaining this virtual experience. So, Father, I pray that you'd give all of us the grace, the humility, the wisdom, Lord, that we would be able to receive from you the fullness of your light that you want to bestow upon us, your life, your truth, and your love. In Jesus' name, amen. So with that, let me share a screen so you can see my visuals. And last time I was with you, which was 2 weeks ago, started a short series that I've prepared, answering a question that I've been getting very frequently, particularly on my social media, and that is, are we alone? Now, let me do this. It says your screen sharing has been paused. Let me try this again. Oh boy. Here we go. Okay, all of you should be seeing my first slide. Is that the case, Mark?
Yes.
Okay, good. All right. And let me get some of this stuff out of the way that you can't see, but I can. Okay. I'll be teaching for 30, 35 minutes. Then we'll do some Q&A. And after that Q&A, we are going to segue into a Zoom meeting. We're in a Zoom webinar right now, which means that only those of us who are hosts and co-hosts can have our cameras and the microphones on. But we will go into a Zoom meeting, and that's where everybody can turn on their microphones and cameras, and we can get to know one another, do some role plays, some testimonies. And so this is the URL you're going to need to get into that meeting. The URL is posted at paradoxes.org. We'll put it in the chat, and I'll pop this slide up again before we go into the web meeting. But the series I launched a couple of weeks ago was this question, are we alone? And this has become a rather popular debate on social media about the last 6 months worth. And it's a question, is there life beyond planet Earth? And in particular, is there intelligent life beyond planet Earth? And in one sense, we know there must be intelligent life beyond Earth from a biblical perspective, because the Bible tells us God created angels. But these angelic beings are different from us. Both humans and angels are intelligent beings, but we humans are constrained by the physics of the universe. The angels are not. They can come into the universe, but they're not constrained by the universe. They're not constrained by the laws of physics of the universe or the space-time dimensions of the universe, but we're different. But the question I think we're really wanting to answer is, are we alone in the sense, are we the only intelligent beings, physical beings, that are constrained by the physics and the dimensions of the universe? And as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, this is a debate that's been flourishing in the Christian community literally since the first century AD. So for the past 2,000 years, Christians have been debating this. And as I mentioned, we get Christians on both sides of the debate. And so we covered 2 weeks ago what the Bible says about this. I'm going to add a couple more verses because I just made a comment 2 weeks ago that the Bible is explicit in saying God is the creator of all life. And here are some passages that lay this out. This is in Isaiah 42, verse 5. This is what God the Lord says, the creator of the heavens, who stretches them out, who spreads out the earth with all that springs from it, who gives breath to its people and life to all who walk on it. So it's basically making the claim that God is the one who brings life to all the creatures that walk upon the face of the earth. And you also see this passage in Isaiah 44, 24, I am the Lord, I am the Lord who made everything. So God takes the credit for everything that God exists. These are a couple of passages out of many we find in the Bible where God declares that he is the creator of all life, not just some of the life, but all of the life here on the planet Earth. And we'll be going into the scientific evidence for that. If you want to go into this in detail, about a year and a half ago, we did a series here in Paradoxes on the book of Isaiah and what Isaiah says about the doctrine of creation. And I've written a blog on this that you can access. It's up on our website. The blog is titled, Does the Book of Isaiah Teach the Trinity? And it's a Today's New Reason to Believe. That's the title of the blog that I bring out virtually every week, a new article. And that's one that I brought out on July 20th, 2020. But actually, if you just put Isaiah into the search engine on reasons.org, the article will pop up. And that actually lists all the passages in the book of Isaiah that talk about the Trinity, but also talk about how God is the one and only creator, and in particular, the creator of all life that exists. So that kind of gives you a background in that Christians have always acknowledged that if life exists elsewhere in the universe, God is the creator of that life, just like he has been here on planet Earth. And so it's different from the debate that goes on in the SETI community. SETI stands for the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligent Life, where they believe that intelligent life can spontaneously appear just from the laws of physics and the natural realm without divine intervention. Christians have always recognized that that's not what the Bible teaches. But Christians have been open to the idea, well, if God created life on planet Earth, certainly he's got the power to create it elsewhere. And so, as I mentioned 2 weeks ago, the two sides of the debate basically focus on, does the book of Hebrews constrain what God has done in the way of creating life elsewhere in the universe? And what you see in Hebrews 10, 12, and 14 is that the priests had offered for all time one sacrifice, this priest. This priest, of course, referring to Jesus Christ, the second person of the Trinity. It says, this priest, the creator of all life on planet Earth, had offered for all time one sacrifice for sins. By one sacrifice, he's made perfect forever those who are made holy. And a number of theologians have looked at this text, and literally all you see in chapter 10 of the book of Hebrews is saying, well, there might be life elsewhere in the universe that God has created, but there wouldn't be life that's in need of spiritual redemption. Although there are theologians that said, hey, given that it's Jesus Christ, perhaps his one sacrifice here on planet Earth somehow is efficacious for sinners all over the universe. But most theologians believe this would indicate that there's only one place in the universe where you've got intelligent beings that are in need of salvation. I just turned that phone off. I'm sorry. And so it's really wide open. You could have God creating dolphins on another planet, grass on another planet. He could even create beings like us on another planet that have not sinned and therefore are not in need of redemption. And again, there are theologians who claim even spiritual beings on another planet, physical spiritual beings that are in need of redemption, maybe there's some way that Christ sacrificed one time, one place for all could accommodate them as well. A bit speculative, but there are people who take that speculation. And this again is another passage is making the point that God is the author of all life. And basically looking at Psalm 104 and what you see in the book of Isaiah is that when you read Psalm 104, God fills the earth with as much life as possible, as diverse as possible, for as long as possible. And people have cited this text as saying, therefore, God really enjoys creating. Why would he stop at just one planet? Given how vast the universe is, why not have him creating life elsewhere? He seems to really enjoy doing that. And like you got this text, he did not create Earth to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. And some theologians have said, well, maybe it could actually not only refer to planet Earth, but maybe the universe. He didn't create the universe to be empty, but formed it to be inhabited. And then we have people on the other side who say, now, wait a minute. When you look at the Gospels, what we notice is Jesus only performs the necessary miracles to achieve his purpose. We don't see him performing gratuitous miracles. He only performs the miracles he needs to achieve his purpose. And his purpose is to prepare physical, spiritual beings for entry into the new creation, does he really need more than one planet? And so using the argument that God conserves his miracles, performs as few miracles as is necessary to fulfill his purpose, they argue that this is the one and only place where God has created physical, intelligent life, or any life at all. So they would actually extend this to say they believe Earth is the only place where God has created life. And for 2,000 years, Christians have debated whether or not extraterrestrial life exists. This is significant because there is an element within the non-Christian community that actually believes that if astronomers find life beyond planet Earth, this would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. So the very fact that Christians, theologians, have been debating one another on both sides of the debate basically refutes that proposition that the discovery of life elsewhere would be catastrophic to the Christian faith. Mainly what they're saying is if we find life all over the universe, wouldn't that be evidence that this life spontaneously came about just through the natural laws, that God wasn't involved at all? But even if we were to discover life on, say, 10,000 planets beyond our solar system, that would not be proof that the life spontaneously arose. God could have done it 10,000 times. And that question really needs to be addressed by science. Now, looking at, is it really conceivable that life could spontaneously arise without divine intervention? And we ask that question in the context of the simplest microbe, but then is it conceivable that a simple microbe could evolve naturalistically into advanced human beings? And this gets us into the next question. What does nature's book really got to say? But the key point is neither the existence or the non-existence of extraterrestrial life has any significant bearing on the Christian faith. So this idea of running around in the SETI community that the discovery of life would put the end to all religious belief, that's simply not the case. And it's not just Christians that have been debating this issue. People in other religious backgrounds, Muslims have been debating this, Hindus have been debating this, and we find people on both sides of the fence. Well, normally on April 1st, I post something satirical or humorous that fits in with that day on my social media pages. And I was advised by our staff not to do that because they don't often recognize that I'm being humorous. They think I'm being serious. I mean, it was a couple of years ago where I put a post on this day, April 1st, our state California legislature passed a law where they're going to require all animals and people to wear specially designed bags to capture the methane they emit so that we could use that methane to drive industry and not have to use fossil fuels. People actually thought I was being serious. And what I realized is people outside the state of California really do think our state legislature is that far gone. And I'm not going to get into the politics, but everybody was saying, hey, maybe he could have gotten away with that joke if he didn't live in California. So they said this year, please don't put anything humorous or satirical up. What I found out, however, is that when I put my post up on April 1st, it was a serious post. Nevertheless, people took advantage of that day to post something quite humorous. And someone who heard about the topic, Are We Alone, made this post. I'm going to share it with you because it was just too good not to share with you. And so they made the comment, notice NGC 4622, it's a galaxy with symmetrical spiral arms. The most symmetrical spiral arms we see in any galaxy outside of our own Milky Way galaxy. Now, as an astronomer, I look at this image and realize just what I see there tells me this is a galaxy that's not a candidate for advanced life. Notice that there's no bar in the center. You need a barred spiral galaxy for it to have the possibility of advanced life for a number of reasons I'll be discussing in my next book, Design to the Core. And also notice just how many of the stars and matters in the center this is a galaxy that's going to have a really big supermassive black hole. But it does have symmetrical spiral arms. But notice that some of those arms merge together. So there's actually several reasons why this galaxy is not a candidate for advanced life. But a number of people thought, hey, it's a great candidate because look how symmetrical the spiral arms are. Well, somebody on my social media took advantage of this to make the following post. I just have to share this with you. And their comment was, NASA just made a huge announcement. They have detected a modulating electromagnetic signal coming out from the galaxy NGC 4622, which is in the constellation Centaurus. It isn't from any natural source. This is the biggest discovery in the history of mankind. The electromagnetic signal actually contains a binary code. And this is what the binary code says, which scientists have been able to decipher using their advanced computers. It simply says, we're calling about your car's expired warranty. This is a courtesy call, and it's the last call we'll make before we close your file. Please contact us immediately to resolve this. And if you're like me, you get these kinds of calls on your phone all the time. And according to this person, the source is extraterrestrial. However, what I realize is, hey, if this is the case, ET is multilingual because I get this message both in English and in Mandarin. Here in California, we have a lot of Asians, so we get it in two languages. Probably people get it in multiple languages. However, I would argue that ET apparently is not intelligent enough to figure out how to close my file because I keep getting these calls and they never close my file. You've probably had similar experiences, but hey, April's Fools. That's a great April Fool's post that we received here. Okay, where we ended up 2 weeks ago on this discussion was making the point that in looking at the book of nature, it's clear that life cannot originate without divine intervention. So we see from the science that if ET is out there, it's there by the hand of God, that the book of Isaiah is accurate in stating that all life is present because of the supernatural intervention of the creator of the universe. And what we covered last time is the scientific evidence that the origin of life occurred without time or very little time, because we see evidence, isotope evidence for life here on planet Earth at the very first instance where that life could possibly survive here on planet Earth, 3.825 billion years ago. Earlier than that, the surface of the Earth was too hot and too unstable for the existence of life. And we now recognize that life originated on planet Earth without the benefit of a primordial soup. In other words, when we look at the isotopes of these carbonaceous molecules on planet Earth, at the time that life originated, they're 100% postbiotic. We see no prebiotic. Prebiotic carbonaceous molecules have different isotope ratios of carbon, of nitrogen, and of sulfur than is the case for biotic or postbiotic carbonaceous molecules. And at the time of the origin of life, we see lots of evidence for postbiotic prebiotic molecules, but no evidence whatsoever for the prebiotics. The prebiotics simply weren't there. And I took a course from Carl Sagan on the origin of life when I was at the University of Toronto, and he made the point, hey, if you want life to originate, you need lots of time and you need a very abundant prebiotic soup. And the evidence tells us we don't have the time and we don't have the soup either. And then you got the oxygen ultraviolet paradox. If you got oxygen in Earth's atmosphere and in Earth's ocean, that oxygen stops prebiotic chemistry. If you look at the Uri Miller experiment, they made sure there wasn't even the tiniest amount of oxygen in the flask, because even the tiniest amount of oxygen stops the production of the nucleobases and the amino acids. But if you don't have oxygen, ultraviolet radiation comes in, because you need oxygen to establish an ozone shield to prevent the short wavelength ultraviolet radiation from reaching Earth's surface. And just like with oxygen, if you've got short wavelength ultraviolet radiation, that too stops the prebiotic chemistry. So it's a lose-lose situation. If you got oxygen, you can't have the origin of life. If you don't have oxygen, you can't have the origin of life either. And there's no source to make all the molecules homochiral. If you want to be able to assemble the amino acids and the amino acids must be 100% left-handed. Now, conceivably, you could do with 100% right-handed, but either way, you can't have a random mixture of left and right-handed amino acids. And I talked last week about experiments that have been done by Origin of Life chemists, where they have found that the only pathway towards homochirality is to use circularly polarized ultraviolet light, which preferentially destroys the right-handed amino acids at a faster rate than the left-handed amino acids. But in both cases, you're destroying the amino acids. And they found that the limit was 80%. Using laboratory, controlled experiments, they discovered as they got towards 80%, the sample was basically gone. And if you extrapolate to 100, it doesn't matter how big a sample you start with of amino acids, you have zero amino acids left long before you get to 100% homochirality, where all the amino acids are left-handed. You got the same problem with the DNA and the RNA, because for the nucleobases to be assembled in a DNA and RNA, the sugars, which are crucial, the ribose sugars that are crucial for gluing together these nucleobases, they have to be 100% right-handed. And in nature, it comes out as a random 50-50 mixture. And again, the processes to drive the ribose sugars to make them all right-handed is similar to the amino acids. You wind up destroying the left-handed more efficiently than the right-handed ribose sugars. But likewise, you wind up with no ribose by the time you get anywhere close to getting a homochiral situation. And then the problem is you got very few building block molecules. I said 2 weeks ago we got no. That's a bit of an exaggeration. I do believe that interstellar molecular clouds will produce amino acids and nucleobases and the sugars, but they're going to be producing them at very low abundance levels. So far, we have yet to detect in these interstellar molecular clouds are really, that is the fundamental source for these building block molecules for life. No matter where you have life originating, the ultimate source is from these interstellar molecular clouds. And we astronomers have yet to detect any 5 or 6 carbon sugars or any nucleobases or amino acids. Now, in the literature, there are claims saying that they did find glycine, the simplest of the amino acids. That claim needs to be taken out because there's a paper published in the Astrophysical Journal where they said the claim was based on a misidentified spectral lines. And so glycine's not been discovered. And that's an amino acid with only 10 atoms, and it's the simplest of the amino acids. And so we've yet to find a single amino acid in any interstellar molecular cloud. There was also an announcement about 15 years ago that they had found a nucleobase. That too has now been recognized to be misidentified spectral lines. However, these were instruments that were looking for these molecules at maybe 100 parts per billion. Now we've got the technology to discover these molecules at 1 part per billion. And some of my astronomer friends are working on new detectors that maybe can get us down to 100 parts per trillion. And I think when we get down to 100 parts per trillion, we know enough about the chemistry in these interstellar molecular clouds that we know that these molecules are being constructed, well, at least some of them. You'll find an article I've written on reasons.org about a family of amino acids that we know can't possibly be constructed by any naturalistic means. That would be tryptophan, arginine. These are what are called the basic amino acids, those amino acids that need a high pH to be constructed. And the article I wrote on reasons.org basically explains why naturalistic processes are not going to produce these molecules, but they will be able to produce the simpler amino acids like glycine. And indeed, we've found six of these amino acids in meteorites, although a number of astronomers have said maybe those amino acids we've found at just a few parts per million are contamination. And some have argued, well, maybe some are original and maybe some are contaminated. Maybe most of them are contaminated. But we know enough about the chemistry in interstellar molecular clouds to realize the chemistry will make some of the amino acids and probably make three of the four nucleobases bases that we see present in DNA. But they're going to be making them at a very low abundance level. Why? Because the chemistry that constructs these molecules, there's other chemical processes in these interstellar molecular clouds that destroy the molecules, which is why we've not found them yet. Because yes, you got the chemistry making them, but you got the chemistry destroying them. And already we know that the abundance levels are below one part per billion. That's the upper limit that we now have on us, many of these molecules. And hey, if it's less than one part per billion, this is useless for any naturalistic model for the origin of life. That's simply way too low of an abundance to argue that even over 4 billion years, these molecules could bump into one another and self-assemble. So that rules out the possibility of life on planet Earth. And also, first life is highly complex. A number of papers have been written saying, hey, maybe we could pull together a microbe that's only got 250 gene products. That would be for a parasitical microbe, a microbe that can only exist by feeding off of other microbes. The simplest life form, this is in our book, Origins of Life. And we wrote that in 2004. We got an update in 2014. It's still true to this day that the simplest life form that's conceivable would be one that's got 1,400 gene products. That's the simplest independent existing life form, a life form that could exist without more complex life to support it. And with 1,400 gene products, that's way beyond any conceivable mathematical model for taking amino acids, nucleobases, and sugars and making the necessary proteins, amino acids from proteins, DNA, RNA. And as my colleague Fazal Rana would point out, you got the lipid problem. Lipids are not easy to make. And those that would be the membrane that houses the DNA, the RNA, and the proteins. And so that's another major problem. Life can't exist unless it's living within this shielded boundary. And those lipid molecules are, again, extremely difficult to pull together. So, you know, we've been at Origin of Life conferences where people have argued, well, we get the RNA molecules first, which then when then we get the DNA, and then we get the proteins, and then we get the lipids. But the truth of the matter is you need all four showing up simultaneously in order for life to exist. You have to have the lipid membranes, you got to have the DNA, you got to have the RNA, got to have the proteins all showing up at the same time. So it's not just the problem of making a simple RNA molecule, you got to make the whole complex nature of molecules that make up the simplest life form. And, you know, what was interesting, Origin of Life research conferences that Buzz and I have attended, they very quickly came to the conclusion life cannot possibly originate on planet Earth by any naturalistic mechanism. It must have originated Mars, and some meteorite must have brought it from Mars to planet Earth. Now, I'd argue that the reverse is definitely possible, that a meteorite striking Earth would cause Earth's soil to be exported throughout the solar system and therefore deposit the remains of life on the moon and Mars and every solar system body. And I've been on public record since the 1980s. It's just a matter of time before we find the remains of life on different solar system bodies. The easiest place to find it would be the moon, because the moon gets the biggest delivery of Earth soil. But Mars gets enough Earth soil that we expect to find about 20 kilograms of Earth soil on every 100 square kilometers. Now, 100 square kilometers, that's a lot of area. So that's a very thin layer of Earth soil that exists on the surface of Mars. But I've argued in the book Origins of Life that we put out that as difficult as it is naturalistically to conceive of life originating on planet Earth, it's far more problematic on other planetary bodies. Mars is a much more difficult place to conceive of the origin of life. You got the same thing that you got on planet Earth. There's no time for the life, no significant time. And what's unique about Mars compared to the Earth, Earth doesn't have a carbonate crisis, Mars does. And so we now know that Mars originally had a warm, wet environment, reasonably warm and reasonably wet, not as warm and wet as the Earth was. But with that warm, wet environment, you get a carbonate crisis. Because Mars did not have long-lasting, strong plate tectonic activity, it's simply not big enough for that to happen. What takes place is, yes, you got that liquid water, but it combines with the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, makes carbonates, and there's no plate tectonic activity to recycle those carbonates back into water and carbon dioxide. So very quickly, the warm, wet conditions on Mars become cold and dry. And we now know that Mars has been cold and dry for the past 4 billion years. And so yes, you can conceive of planets that do have liquid water at warm enough temperatures, but unless you've got a very strong, long-lasting plate tectonic activity, that wet, warm condition will quickly evolve as it did on Mars. And in the case of Venus, Venus is close enough to the sun that you get an electric field in the atmosphere of Venus. We can measure it to this day. And I've written an article you can find on reasons.org about what happens when you've got an electric field that's stronger than 2 volts in the atmosphere of a planet. It again causes an extremely rapid desiccation of the planet. So it explains why Venus today has no water. And that, by the way, would happen with any planet that's sufficiently close to its star. And so, and that's what I find interesting about the NASA program to find life elsewhere, is that they're really focusing their efforts on planets that are orbiting their host stars more closely than Earth orbits the sun. But the Earth is really the closest that you can get to the sun without getting an electric field in the atmosphere that quickly desiccates the planet. And so bottom line is, planets orbiting their host stars at a distance closer than the sun orbits, the Earth orbits the sun, will suffer that catastrophe where the electric field, again, the closer you are to your host star, the stronger the atmospheric electric field. So the planet has an atmosphere like Venus does, it very quickly becomes a bone dry. And without an enduring plate tectonic activity, you're not going to get a magnetosphere. And incidentally, you need a lot more than just plate tectonics to get a magnetosphere. I'll cover that in a few minutes about why. And without a magnetosphere, you're not going to have a shield about the planet that will protect the planet from deadly stellar radiation from its host star and cosmic radiation. And so the Van Allen belts that encircle the Earth, it's basically a magnetic shield set up by the dynamo in the core of our planet that protects us from that deadly radiation. And there's a paper published almost a year ago now that basically makes the point that it's virtually impossible for a planet to have a strong enough magnetosphere to prevent the planet from becoming completely sterilized. I'll get into that in a couple of minutes. And just as with planet Earth, you got an oxygen ultraviolet paradox. That's a paradox that applies to all planets. Again, making the point, without supernatural intervention, you're not going to have an origin of life. You got the same homochorality problem. You got the same problem that you're not going to have sufficient building blocks. And so this literally applies to all planets except planet Earth. Planet Earth is the exception in that it had an early strong magnetosphere that prevented our planet from losing its atmosphere and losing its water. I think I covered this briefly in the class about a year ago. I got an article on our website that discusses this in detail. It's going to be in my next book, Design to the Core. And let me catch up my second computer. I'm so looking forward to meeting in person, and we will sustain the virtual experience. So that'll be just like it is today. But yeah, it'll be fun to be back in front of a live audience and where I only have to manage one computer instead of two. But what you'll find in the article that I've written on our website is that there was a collision between two planets and between the proto-Earth and the planet Theia, where the planet Theia was about twice the size of Mars. This happened when the Earth was less than 100 million years old. And it was that collision event that gave us a bigger planet. So Earth became larger as a result, and it led to the formation of the moon. And 4.4 billion years ago, the Earth and the moon were about this far apart from one another. So they're very close to one another. And, you know, for reasons that are explained in my books, we got the moon spiraling away from the Earth. And so as soon as the moon was formed, it began to spiral away from the Earth, mainly because of the tidal interaction between the Earth and the moon. So that tidal interaction basically forces the moon to spiral away. That's going to continue for the next 40 billion years. Say, what's going to happen after that? Well, 40 billion years from now, the tidal interaction between the Earth and the moon will cause both the Earth and the moon to have the identical rotation rate. It'll be a rotation rate of about 40 days. And when that happens, the spiraling away effect of the moon from the Earth will stop and reverse. And then the moon's going to gradually get closer and closer to the Earth. And another 40 billion years after that, 80 billion years from now, the moon will collide with the Earth, and that will be the end of the moon. But other nasty things are going to happen long before that 80 billion year incident. But the moon is spiraling away from the Earth. And because both the moon and the Earth came as a result of this merger event between Theia and the proto-Earth, that caused the interior cores of both bodies to become very hot. And so, we have the core of the Earth being heated up as a result of the collision, and likewise, the moon that formed as a result likewise had a very hot core. And this is where the Earth and the moon were 4 billion years ago. You can see they've moved quite a bit apart from one another. And this is where they are right now. So now they're really far apart from one another. And the moon is moving away from the Earth by about 2.5 centimeters every year. And within a few hundred thousand years, you're not going to see total solar eclipses anymore because the moon will have spiraled far enough away from the Earth that the moon's disk will not be able to completely block out the sun's disk. It reasons to believe we're organizing another total solar eclipse expedition. We did one in 2017 up in the desert of Oregon. And in 2024, we're going to have another expedition to a place that we just reserved a little bit north of San Antonio, Texas. And that will be a total solar eclipse. But hey, catch it, because within a few hundred thousand years, there'll be no more total solar eclipses. And even right now, only 2/3 of the eclipses of the sun are total. The other third are what we call annular, where the disk of the moon is such that it doesn't fully cover the disk of the sun. And that's because in the moon's orbit about the sun, sometimes it gets a little closer to the Earth, sometimes a little farther away from the Earth. But hey, if you were there with us in Oregon, that was a great eclipse for seeing the corona. You could see the corona out to a factor of about 10 moon diameters away from the moon. So you got to see the full corona in all of its glory. the eclipse that's going to be happening in north of San Antonio, it's going to be eclipse of more than twice the duration of the one that was in Oregon. The Oregon one was only about 2 minutes. But what's great about that is that's where you have the disk of the moon almost perfectly covering the disk of the Earth. And therefore, you get to see this corona way out. But it doesn't get dark. It only got dark enough for us to see the planets. It didn't get dark enough to see stars. The one in San Antonio, we have the moon a little bit closer to the Earth, and the eclipse is going to be about 4.5 minutes, and it will get dark. And by the way, it gets kind of cold. Even in Oregon, we experienced the temperature dropping about 20 degrees during the eclipse. But hey, I'm sidetracking here. This is where we are right now. But if we go back 4 billion years ago, we got the Earth and the Moon close enough together where the tidal interaction between the Earth and the Moon circulates that hot liquid inner core of the Earth and the Moon. And that liquid core of the Earth and the Moon was predominantly ferrous metals, iron, cobalt, and nickel, metals that are easily magnetized. And it takes two things to get a dynamo in the center of a planet. It takes a big hot core, liquid core of ferrous metals, and necessary that that liquid be circulating. So you need something to set up convection currents inside the core of both the Earth and the Moon. And the tidal interaction between the Earth and the Moon previous to 4 billion years ago was strong enough to circulate the liquid iron in the core of the Moon and the liquid iron in the core of the Earth. And it's a coupling of those two magnetospheres, because you know that magnetic field in the Moon set up a magnetosphere around the Moon and a magnetosphere around the Earth. And the two bodies are close enough together that the two magnetospheres coupled with one another. And that gave the Earth a strong enough magnetic shield to stop the particle radiation coming out from the sun from basically sputtering away all of our atmosphere and all of our water. And so if it wasn't for the Earth and the Moon being so close together at that time, both of them having a hot origin where the tidal friction between the Earth and the Moon could circulate the liquid iron in the cores of both bodies, we would have been in trouble. We would have been in trouble because at that time, the particle radiation and the flaring activity from the sun was so powerful, it would have evaporated away all of Earth's water and all of Earth's atmosphere without the moon contributing. If the Earth was alone, even if the Earth had a liquid core, you wouldn't have had anything to circulate that liquid iron core. It took the moon being close enough to the Earth to circulate the liquid iron in the core of the Earth so that we could get a magnetic field. Now, people say, well, how come we have a magnetic field today? Well, what happened is when the moon moved away where we no longer had that tidal interaction. By the way, the moon is still sufficiently close to the Earth that its tidal interaction does circulate a little bit of the liquid iron in the Earth's core, but it's not strong enough in the way of what it circulates to give us a strong enough magnetic shield to protect life on planet Earth. What has happened in the meantime, the liquid core of the Earth has cooled enough where you have a solid inner core and you got an outer liquid core. Now, previous to 4 billion years ago, the core was totally liquid. But when you got a solid core and a liquid core, you got chemical reactions taking place at the core, the boundary between the solid core and the liquid core that strongly circulates the iron in the liquid core. And that's what keeps our magnetic field going today. But it only works because we have a solid core and a liquid outer core, solid inner core and a liquid outer core. And this graph is logarithmic, basically showing that the particle radiation and the flaring activity was 100,000 times greater previous to 4 billion years ago than it is today. And so we're not at the same risk today that we were 4 billion years ago. But it takes the coupling of the moon's magnetic field with the Earth's magnetic field in order to prevent the catastrophe of our planet losing its water and its atmosphere, and therefore no possibility for life. And so again, this is the situation 4 billion years ago, where the core of the Earth is entirely liquid and it's circulated by the tidal forces of the moon. And today we have a solid inner core and an outer liquid core. And the interaction between the inner core and the outer core sets up strong circulations in the liquid core, which gives us our magnetic field. And so this explains why Earth has had a strong enough magnetic field to establish a magnetosphere around our planet that protects our planet. But here's the bottom line. If you want to have any possibility for life, you're going to need to have an Earth-Moon system identical to the Earth-Moon, and identical not only in its physical characteristics, but in its history, where the two bodies start off close together with very hot cores, and then they spiral away from one another, where you have this transformation of the liquid core going from a solid, totally liquid core to a solid inner core and an outer liquid core. And this is all possible because we have heat. I'm just going to quickly, I'm way past my time, so I'm going to stop at this point. But just kind of give you the bottom line here that unless you got a planet-moon system identical to the Earth-Moon system, both in its physical characteristics and its precise history of development formation, has to form the same way and has to have a future development the same way, there's no possibility for life. In fact, of all the articles I've seen in the scientific literature in the past 10 years, I rank this one as number one in giving us the most potent new evidence for the fine-tuning argument that, hey, unless you got a God that's very carefully controlling and fine-tuning of the different features of our galaxy, our star, our planet, our moon, et cetera, there's no possibility for life to exist anywhere within this vast universe. So let me stop at this point. I'll pick it up there next time I'm with you. And let me figure out how to get out of this. Oh yeah, here we go. I think we're back.
We have some great questions, Hugh.
Okay.
The first one is from Travis Worth, who asks, could aliens be beings from a higher spatial dimension?
Well, yes, they could be. And we've already had some interactions with them. They're called angels. You know, God created two different species of intelligent life. And yes, angels are in a different dimensional realm than we are. What's interesting is that they can come into our realm and leave our realm. We cannot, at least not in this life. I mean, the afterlife, maybe, but in this life, we are constrained to the physics and the dimensions of this universe. And that's another whole debate. People who believe the Bible is the word of God, they're all persuaded that angels are real and that these angels can come and go. And you read the book of Acts, you read the Old Testament, you see many stories there of incidences where angels have had contact with human beings. You got Hebrews 13:2, which tells us that many of us believers in Jesus Christ have entertained angels unawares. As it tells us in the book of Hebrews, these angels assist us in our ministries. So if something supernatural happens to you in your ministry here on earth, maybe you need to give the credit to an angel.
Thank you. Chris Thompson from Anchorage says, there appears to be a massive shift away from in-person worship post-COVID. Churches are being closed or emerging with other more viable ones. Christian identification is undergoing a major downward shift in the faith community. Some megachurches see migration to virtual reality as the new direction. Could you share your thoughts about this direction and concerns for the future of the Great Commission?
Yes, I mean, for the past 2.5 years, this Paradoxes class has been a virtual experience. because COVID didn't permit us to meet in person. And I'm really looking forward to going back to the in-person meetings. But the virtual church isn't going away. I mean, a lot of people are saying, hey, I'm going to catch the church service virtually, and then I'm going to go to a class afterwards that is in a different location. So I think what we're going to see in the future is a lot of people mixing their virtual church experience with their traditional church experience. So I don't think it's going to be either or. I think it's going to be both and. But yeah, there is a new development, not just the virtual church, but the virtual reality church, where you have to actually put on goggles and you get to have kind of a 3D experience. And there's other experiences you can have. Virtual reality is really advancing, where you're going to have touch and smell. I don't know how they're going to work out taste, but it's basically emulating the experiences that we have. And yes, there are some concerns in that virtual church, virtual reality. By the way, I know of three virtual reality churches that are already operating, where everybody's putting on their goggles and, quote, having their church experience. And it wouldn't surprise me that 2 years from now, there might be 1,000 virtual reality churches around. And it does offer a superior experience to what you get through Zoom, but it's just not the same as having in-person contact. And I've seen that. I'm now getting on airplanes. This is one reason why I haven't been here every Sunday, is reasons to believe is having me travel to different places for real in-person meetings. And what my experience has been is that people really value those meetings. And it's like for 2 years we've been locked up, and now we finally get back to the way God intended. I mean, we are social beings, and Fuzz and I are both writing papers, articles on just how distinct we are from other life here on planet Earth. Yes, we have insects that are social. We've got wolves, and you also have primates that are social, but it's nothing compared to what we human beings are able to manifest. We're able to manifest social interaction at a very high hierarchical level, all the way up to a nation, worldwide, and even as small groups. And that requires intimate face-to-face contact. People can hide in the virtual world. It's harder to hide when you're engaging people face-to-face. And the New Testament is filled with passages and the benefits of keeping one another accountable. But yeah, the virtual church, the Zoom church, it's a great place where you don't want to have people really know what you really are like. But if they don't know what you're really like, then that can really impede your spiritual growth.
Is it possible that as this notion of virtual reality, you know, with the goggles or some other means, there could be other means of giving people a 3D immersive experience, could affect the Great Commission in a way that would harm our ability to reach people for Christ?
Well, again, I don't think it's either or. And by the way, it's not just going to be goggles. Virtual reality is evolving to a point where you actually put on a full suit. So this is where they're able to emulate not just one sense, your sense of sight, but everything, hearing, touch, etc. So virtual reality is going to get a lot more sophisticated. And it's going to enable us to communicate the gospel to a lot more people. I mean, you know, I remember 20 years ago teaching paradoxes, where we would get 100 people in a room where we would be talking. I can tell you that sometimes the recordings of this paradoxes class, now that we're going virtual, reaches over 50,000 people. So some of these class episodes have had that kind of worldwide exposure. So there are advantages, but it's not the same as having face-to-face contact. And what I appreciate about reading the Gospels, look at the amount of time that Jesus invested in just 12 individuals. And so virtual reality, the Zoom experience, the virtual experience, it's a great way to getting the message out to a huge audience all over the world. But there's a shallowness to it that you don't get with real personal face-to-face contact and accountability. So my worry is we're going to lose the accountability that's necessary to really mature in Christ.
Thank you. Susan Lambeau says, are there lipids which can show up naturally if there was no biological life? Can lipids be strictly natural without life?
Yes, but what the challenge is, I mean, if you've got a lipid surface that's just kind of out there, that's not of any use. It's got to be a lipid surface that actually encapsulates. So you need a globe. And then when you look at these lipid membranes that encapsulate the cells, they're not just lipids. You've got these protein pores, because it's kind of like the borders of a nation. You need to have customs units there that are basically governing what comes into the country and what leaves the country. Likewise, for a cell to be viable, you need these protein pores all over the lipid surface that basically determine what compounds can come into the cell and what compounds can be ejected, because there's a very sophisticated garbage disposal system inside the cell. And all that stuff has got to be ejected outside the cell, but also the cell needs to be able to harvest material from outside the cell. And that's all governed by these very complex protein pores. They're all over the cells of different bodies. So lipids by themselves are not enough. And hey, I don't know of any naturalistic scenario that's able to produce lipids that produce a globe where you've got everything inside protected from everything outside. It's easy to get a small piece of a lipid, but getting one that looks like the membrane of a cell, that's the challenge.
Thank you. Ron Hawking asks, how is it possible to have beings like us on another planet that never sinned? Does that mean Satan was not invited?
Well, that's definitely an option. I mean, what we see here on planet Earth is God created Adam and Eve, and he invited Satan into the garden. And so it's conceivable, and this has been debated by Christians literally for the past two millennia, that it'd be possible that God created beings like us on another planet and made sure that Satan never got close to them. And therefore it'd be conceivable that perhaps they've never sinned. And maybe he created beings with a weaker free will. I mean, people ask me the question all the time, couldn't God have created us in such a way that we wouldn't have sinned? Yes, he could have made us all robots, so we would be programmed never to sin. Or he could have created us with a weak free will, where we would be so dominated by God's free will that we would never sin. But if God creates us with a weak free will, that means we can only experience weak love. And that's the message of the Bible. God wanted beings that would be able to experience strong love, love at an unbelievable level that can be expressed and received. And for that to be possible, he has to grant us strong free will. And with strong free will, it's inevitable that some of those beings will choose to rebel against God rather than submit to him. So even if you don't have Satan invading, if you've got beings with a strong free will, you will have some that will choose to sin. What we see happening with Adam and Eve is they had strong free will, as all of us do. And God made sure that the first person to tempt them was a being that had the greatest level of power and intelligence, because that's Satan. He's the most powerful, most intelligent, most capable being that God ever created. And as I've explained in several of my books, that means we get challenged by the greatest evil possible. And if we can pass the test of the greatest evil that exists in the universe, we can gain eternal security. I won't go into any more than that because that would take another 20 minutes, Mark, but it's in a whole chapter of Beyond the Cosmos.
Great, thank you. So our friend Tom Wee from Germany says, Dr. Ross, I have never been convinced that life could spontaneously originate. And I remember having a discussion with my former chemistry and physics science teacher about this. As for the Bible verses that teach the origin of simple life, I've assumed this is included in the third creation day when God created plants. You've put forward the view that the activity of the Holy Spirit originated simple life in Genesis 1:2. Are there any other Bible passages that you think teach the origins of life, of simple life forms?
Yeah, the Bible's silent on microbial life for obvious reasons. The Bible, I believe, has been inspired to communicate to all generations, not just the people living in the 20th and 21st century. And hey, it's only been the last 170 years that we even knew about the existence of microbes. So I wouldn't expect the Bible to be saying anything about microbial life. And, you know, Fuzz and I, when we wrote the book Origins of Life, it's also in my book, you know, Navigating Genesis, that when you look at Genesis 1-2, it uses this special verb for what God is doing. It's translated, God was hovering over the surface of the earth. But it's a Hebrew verb that also shows up at the end of the book of Deuteronomy that describes a female eagle hovering over her eggs that have just hatched. And so that's why a number of Hebrew scholars have concluded that Genesis 1-2 is actually referring to the Holy Spirit bringing life upon planet Earth. And but it is speculative. There are different ways of interpreting Genesis 1-2, but it's certainly conceivable given the context and the Hebrew word definitions that it's actually referring to God creating microbial life just before creation day one. Creation day three is speaking about vegetation proliferating over all the continents. And yet it's important to realize it's using four distinct Hebrew words. It says God created this vegetation to flourish on the continental land masses. Then it gives you three examples. And usually it's translated trees, seed, and fruit. And as I've explained in Navigating Genesis, the original Hebrew words are much more generic than what you see in the English. But desheh, that Hebrew word translated vegetation, would basically apply to any photosynthetic life on the continental landmasses. So that could include both microbial life, algae, as well as advanced life. So the door is open. And you know, that's why I don't make too definitive as a statement in Navigating Genesis about the history of a vegetative life on planet Earth. But that's about the limit of what the Bible talks about. Psalm 104 does make the point that in the present era, it's everywhere. In the deepest ocean, the highest mountain, everywhere you go, you see plant and animal life.
Thank you. Our friend Tim Williams says, does the last universal common ancestor, Luca, have to be before the 3.85 billion years ago time? Does evolutionary biology accept this? And how do they approach the lack of time problem?
Well, a quote that I probably should have put into my talk, it's from the atheist evolutionary biologist, Niles Eldredge. And he comments on this isotope evidence for Earth's early life. And I'm trying to remember the precise quote, but basically what he is saying is life is intrinsic to the Earth. And he prefaces that by saying the earliest, the very moment that you got solid rocks and liquid water in the Earth, you got life. And so he says life appears spontaneously. There's no time separation. And therefore he concludes as an atheist, life must be intrinsic to the Earth. And what he means by that statement is there's something embedded in the physics and the chemistry we don't yet understand, but evidently, as soon as you got rock material cool enough that it actually becomes solid and you got liquid water, you immediately have life. So he doesn't really answer how it happens. He just says there has to be some hidden principle in chemistry of physics that explains that it's the moment you got liquid water and solid rocks, you get life, because that's what the time record tells us. The very first time you got stable liquid water and stable rocks, you got life.
Other than Niles Eldredge assuming that life is intrinsic, are there any other approaches that try to deal with the time problem, the lack of time problem?
Well, what Niles Eldredge is talking about is similar to what you hear coming out of the Santa Fe Institute. And that's an institute, I'm trying to remember the name of the guy that founded it, very famous scientist. And I remember him speaking at Caltech. and making the point that, you know, in the first half of his talk, he basically destroyed the Darwinian paradigm, saying that math, from a mathematical perspective, yeah, Stuart Kaufman's his name, and he's mathematically very adept. And he said, just looking at the mathematics, it's simply not possible that you can go from a microbe to human beings in less than 4 billion years. So he spent most of his lecture destroying the Darwinian paradigm, also applied it to the origin of life. And therefore, people in the Q&A time asked him, well, then, how do you explain the origin of life as someone who's not a theist? And he says, there's a hidden law of thermodynamics that explains how life originates. And he basically referred to it as a fourth law of thermodynamics. And what he meant by that is, you know, thermodynamics basically tells you things go from order to disorder, and everything seems to decay. But he says this fourth law of thermodynamics that he's proposing, he says it's conceivable that there's an exotic site in the universe, a very small volume, where the thermodynamic laws reverse. And so instead of things going from order to disorder, they go from disorder to order. And they go from, simplicity to complexity. And he says that explains the origin of life. And I've critiqued his ideas in The Creator and the Cosmos. I think I critique him in all four editions of The Creator and the Cosmos, first making the point that in order for life to exist in the universe at all, the universe must be uniform and homogeneous on large scales, which basically eliminates the possibility of any such exotic site existing. And Stuart Kaufman's proposal is actually picked up by three atheist theoretical physicists in an article that I also discuss in The Creator and the Cosmos. And they make the point, yes, it's conceivable that there could be a small volume somewhere in the universe where the laws of thermodynamics reverse. But they said that volume would have to be exceptionally small. And they calculated the probability that such a small volume would exist within the observable universe. And I've written an article making the point, the probability they come up with, less than one chance in 10 to the whatever, it's the biggest number I've ever seen in the scientific literature. It's like 10 to the 10 to the 10 to the 100,000. So they basically concluded the paper by saying it can't happen.
It's now 11:48.
Okay.
We have a few more questions, but I don't know how much time you want to spend on this or move into
let's move into the web meeting, and because I think people like what we've been doing is that we begin the web meeting by picking up on more questions, but now we can have some back and forth because I'm actually going to be able to see people. And, there's one reason why I miss the in-person meetings is that when you're dealing with questions, you can look at the person, you can tell whether or not your answer is really hitting them. I like what you always say, Mark, did I respond appropriately to your question? Not being able to see body language makes that difficult. And hey, so we're gonna go into a web meeting. You can turn on your cameras, turn on your microphones, and we can really have some more significant engagement. And what we typically do in those web meetings is we alternate from introductions to a testimony to answering a question. And I typically go from answering a question where I can see you and one that shows up in the chat feature. So with that, I'm going to share screen again so that you can see the URL. Here we go.
That also shows up in the chat for anybody.
Shows up in the chat. It's also at paradoxes.org. And here we go. Okay, I think, does that show up, Mark?
No, we're seeing the Earth's Dynamo Today slide.
Oh, all right. That's not working. Let me stop the share feature and try this again. I had to do this before.
But if they go to the chat, they can cut and paste it and make it work from there too.
Is that still working or not?
It still shows what does the Bible say.
Okay, that's not, okay. I'm just gonna skip this. Because yeah, it is in the chat. It is in the, at paradoxes.org. So what I'm going to do is we'll stop the webinar and then I'll open up a web meeting. And you know, you'll be put into a waiting room. Just give me a minute to get you into the waiting room. And then you can all turn on your cameras and microphones and we can start engaging one another. So, and boy, I see we got a lot in the chat. So should be some good questions there. So let me bring this meeting to an end and I'll see all of you in the web meeting.